The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, the litmus test. It's our election special.
So it's science, it's technology, apprenticeships, raising the status of science teachers.
Also, we'll try to boil down voting to its evolutionary roots and see if we can't compare the three-party leaders to monkeys.
This election is obviously all about becoming Britain's alpha male. An alpha chimpanzee will mean he will get extra mating opportunities and will be able to mate with more females and therefore have more descendants than some of the other males.
Plus, how do chimpanzees cope with death?
The other chimps came along and they were sort of staring at her face. They were gently shaking her. They seemed to be lifting her limbs and letting them drop and looking for signs of life.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello to everyone out there. The Guardian and Observer's science men are here, Ian Sample and Robin McKee. Hello to you both.
Hello, Alok.
Also here is researcher and Guardian science columnist Martin Robbins. Martin, hello.
Hello.
Now, Martin edits The Lay Scientist, a community blog about science, pseudoscience and evidence-based politics. And he's written for The Guardian recently on elections and the science policies of all the parties. In case you've missed the wall-to-wall coverage, Britain is enveloped at the moment in election fever. Prospective parliamentary candidates have been crisscrossing the country to persuade you to send them to Westminster. Now, you've heard all about the education, economics and health policies dealt with ad nauseum. And last week, we even took you through the main party's environmental policies. But today, we're going to focus on science. Martin, let's go through the sort of the mass project you've done on the Guardian Science blog. Let's go through how you got the answers. So you sent out questions to all the main parties. How responsive were they?
You can sort of tell how responsive they were from the order in which we're publishing the articles, pretty much. Some of them got back to me straight away. Lib Dems and Evan Harris. Plaid Cymru were very, very quick. But then the Conservatives were a bit slower, and Labour, I think, were only just getting the answers in. So different sort of degrees. But then some parties have much bigger kind of infrastructures and more people to ask, so it can be a bit harder for them.
Are you sort of optimistic or pessimistic about the way that science will be treated in the next Parliament?
I think most of the parties like science and they're committed to science unless it happens to clash with anything else they're committed to. And I think most parties are committed to evidence-based policies, except where it might happen to clash with any sort of other opinions or ideologies.
In the Daily Mail, for example.
Yes.
So, do you get the sense also that science funding, this has been an issue recently, we're in a terrible economic situation, and the potential is that science research funding from government there's a sense that it's an easy place to cut money.
Yes, I mean, it's not necessarily the most vocal of the areas in terms of campaigning. And as you say, it's an easy target. And I think given the lack of any specific commitments to preserving it and the amount of cuts there's going to be in the next couple of years, I would be amazed if it survived the next couple of years at the rate it is now.
OK, well, on that negative note, let's look at each party in turn then.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
We'll start with the Tories, only because David Cameron, the leader, gave a surprise mention to science in last week's debate.
In the last 13 years, we've lost 60,000 jobs in manufacturing. We've been losing manufacturing industry faster than the 1980s. It's been a complete tragedy. We've got to rebuild. How do we do that? Well, let's start with investing in our science base and making sure great universities like this are producing the scientists and entrepreneurs of the future. Let's make sure we invest in apprenticeships. So much of the government's training budget is wasted, and we say let's have an extra 200,000 apprenticeships. That would make a difference. But you can't ignore the basics of actually making it easier for businesses to employ people. And that's why I come back to this point, that if we keep putting up the cost of one person saying to another person, come and work for me, we're never going to get more employment. So it's science, it's technology, apprenticeships, raising the status of science teachers, making sure we reward entrepreneurship, and yes, having low taxes for businesses. That's part of getting them here and keeping them here.
So in about sort of 4.5 hours of debates between the three party leaders on television, that was the first mention of science, which was quite a surprise, and it came from David Cameron. Now, Martin, he seems to link science basically with manufacturing, with business. I mean, is that the sense you got from what the policies you got from them?
Yes, very much. I mean, not just in terms of science funding, but in all areas, really, climate change, and energy and other sort of scientific issues. There's this very big emphasis on business. A lot of the initiatives, for example, they're talking about creating 25,000 new MEng or MScs, masters students in science and technology. Again, it seems to be very much geared towards business. Whether that means that there's going to be a bit of a price to pay for investment, if it means there's going to be, a continuation of this kind of Peter Mandelson, Lord Drayson emphasis on science as a tool for business, I don't know. There are a lot of statements which are very positive sounding, but which come with kind of clauses which could be interpreted in any number of ways. So, for example, on stem cell research, there's this commitment to sort of, saying that we like it, but that it would be subject to the kind of boundaries set by Parliament. And, of course, that gives quite a lot of opportunity then for, MPs to potentially vote things down. We don't necessarily know what the result of that would be.
Ian?
Well, one thing about the Tories that left me confused, especially when David Cameron talked about the importance of investing in the science base, is that Adam Affrier has spoken about how there need to be, inevitably deep cuts in science funding when the Tories or if the Tories come in. And, which is it? I don't think you can have the party leader saying one thing and the minister who would be responsible saying another. And so I'm lost on what will happen under the Tories for science.
I wonder if David Cameron, Adam Affrier, between them, they've kind of confused basic science research, the stuff that goes through research councils and is curiosity-driven, Large Hadron Collider stuff, and stuff that you use to, create brand new jobs, high-tech sector, etc., the sort of applications of, which also needs funding. Maybe that's what they mean when they think about science. Robin?
My point was less a reaction to what the Tories specifically say, but what David Cameron said. His mention is, as far as I can see, the only one of all the three debates about science. Yet we've had, the past year, we've had science in the headlines in a way that's quite unparalleled. We've had the sacking of David Nutt, we've had Climate Gate, the whole issues of leaked emails, the whole issue about how scientists think. We've had swine flu, were we panicking about swine flu? All these issues raised, and we get one single mention in the three debates. I find that quite extraordinary that it got such low prestige and such slight regard from the candidates.
Well, I think, sorry, just to respond to what you've said there as well, though, one of the kind of issues here is that science isn't, while it may be an important issue, it's not necessarily a party political issue. And one of the things we've seen doing this is that there's a huge amount of cross-party consensus between Labour, Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives. They've all got very similar policies on climate change. They've all got the same line on libel reform, more or less. They all came back with very similar responses on pandemics and how to deal with them. And so it's not really there's not really a debate between the two parties, and hence it's not really an election issue.
Okay. Well, let's move on to Labour. And inevitably, when talking about incumbent parties, you discuss their record rather than anything else. Some of the good points, of course, the Labour government over the last 13 years has presided over a massive increase in basic science research, doubling the funding to research councils and others. There have been several science ministers, but Lord Drayson, who's been in post for a while now, is generally regarded as a good thing. What's your sort of overall take on the Labour sort of answers you got?
Well, I think Lord Drayson is an interesting figure because, like Evan Harris for the Lib Dems, he's very much engaged with the scientific community.
Yeah, he's always there at debates and answering tweets. And
exactly, yeah. You can talk to Lord Drayson on Twitter and generally he'll reply, and you may disagree with him, but I do have respect for him. Even if I disagree with him, he's coming out and stating his position very clearly. In terms of sort of science funding, I mean, I think you have to be slightly careful with some of the statements that maybe people make about their past history. You talked about doubling the science budget over the last 13 years. That might be true in strict financial terms, but we've also had the introduction of things like full economic costing for research proposals since then as well, which means that the cost of a PhD student, the cost of a research project has gone up massively in that time as well. So in terms of the amount of research they're funding in real terms, not necessarily being that much of an increase. It's stayed reasonably kind of level as far as I can tell. But, you know, it's very hard to put a wedge between them and the Tories on a number of issues now, because they both seem to have this very business-centred approach to things, and they both seem to have this habit of liking evidence as long as it doesn't cause too much controversy.
The way that Alan Johnson dealt with the sacking of David Nutt, who was the chair of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, it was embarrassing for them, because they seemed to be a party that was pro-science until it suited them.
Well, I think it was there was a broader disappointment of seeing Labour being held in thrall to the Daily Mail, which I think was one of the things that shocked a lot of people. But then that's been going on for quite some time. And again, it comes back to this thing of if Labour aren't going to stand apart from the Conservatives on issues like this, then what's the point of them?
Slight difference between the Tories and Labour. These REFs that the Labour believes in, that you've got to...
This is the Research Excellence Framework.
Yes, you've got to prove, you've got to actually prove that you're not just that you've got a great project, but it has got good economic potential. The Tories are less keen on that, which I thought was interesting. I think, are they, and the scientists hate it. I just wonder if the Tories are actually a little bit more in touch with what your actual laboratory researcher wants.
It was interesting. It's almost like a role reversal in that area, with Labour being more pro-business there and pro sort of economic, you know, incentives for research, and the Tories have kind of shied away from that a bit. They seem quite happy to let the research councils move away from that, and they're planning on having a whole review of that area. Although, of course, what then happens during that review, we don't necessarily know yet.
A review can also mean that it just gets kicked into the long grass and nothing happens for a long time.
Indeed.
And it just the status quo is maintained. Just one final point on that, on Labour. We've discussed Labour science policy so many times, I don't think we need to go into it huge amounts here. But Paul Drayson, if, as it's expected, Labour don't make the next government, is it a shame that he'll go? Do you think that it would be a shame?
It depends who replaces him, really. I mean, if we lost...
Look at the options.
If we lost Paul Drayson for Evan Harris, for example, I wouldn't mind. If we lost Paul Drayson for Adam Afrié, I'd be concerned, on the basis that Adam Afrié is a bit of a mystery man. He's not really been that engaged with science and science activists. So I'd be looking for somebody who, you know, not necessarily somebody you're always going to agree with, but somebody who is at least willing to come to things and talk to scientists, form a reasoned view.
So let's get on to Evan Harris there. Let's get on to the Lib Dems. Now, Evan Harris, as you say, Martin, is very involved in the sort of scientific sceptical community. He goes around, he does a lot of talks. He's been involved in libel reform, Nutgate, everything. He's almost like the totemic figure for sort of scientists and active people like that. As you said, you wouldn't mind if he did become the science minister. I'm not sure if that's such a good idea, because then he wouldn't be able to needle people as much. He'd actually have some power, he'd actually have some responsibilities and things. But no, let's go through the Lib Dem science policy overall. Give it your marks out of 10.
Well, it's hard to find much fault with it, to be honest. They seem to have a very genuine commitment to science and scientists, which comes across in the way that they engage with them. When you look at, for example, Nick Clegg's answers to the Campaign for Science and Engineering, there's been, you know, a very impressive sort of depth to the answers that he's given, whereas, you know, other leaders have perhaps been a bit more brief and more sterile. He seems to have a genuine passion for science. And in terms of their policy areas, I mean, it's very hard to find flaw with them. They've got the most progressive drug policy of any of the main parties. They're up there in terms of funding. They're the only party that's got a commitment to preserve funding for at least 1 year, however much that means. The only sort of downside slightly was on the energy side of things, where, you know, they seem to have an opposition to nuclear, which is not entirely clear where it comes from, if that's an ideological position or a more sort of economic one. And it's hard to sort of see, when they talk about investment in renewables, how they're going to bring that about, when they've only costed about £400 million for that in the next budget.
In one of the leaders' debates, Nick Clegg did say that the Lib Dem opposition to nuclear power wasn't an ideological one. It was simply that if we're going to try and meet our 2020, 2030, 2050 targets, that we wouldn't have time to build the nuclear power stations that you would need in that time. But it almost seemed to me that he would be willing to be persuaded on something like this.
Well, his exact words were not theological. His objection wasn't theological. And I mean, what that means is very difficult to say. You get the feeling there's quite a bit of compromise within the party that they've come to in putting this manifesto.
It's an odd position
together.
Given how evidence based the rest of their policy is that they would think this, and it's an odd thing given that you can say with for Labour and Conservatives, if they're vague, at least they're consistently vague, whereas the Lib Dems are very clear on certain things and then oddly counter to what everyone else might think on others.
Yeah, it stands out really, that particular area.
Is that disappointing, Ian?
Yeah, I thought of all of the sort of things that were mentioned in the science policy of the Lib Dems. That one stood out like a sore thumb, I think. And you know, this may be a prejudice, but frankly, I don't believe them that it's a concern over how long these things would take to build. I think this is a historic objection to nuclear power that I suspect they have, you know, their other reasons. And I think it would make sense if they just explained what they were and if they still stand by them. I mean, that I might be completely wrong, but that's my gut feeling, and I suspect I'm right.
Robin, would it sort of ward you against a Lib Dem vote?
Oh, it's not that I hate the Lib Dems. No, I've got a lot of time for them, but I find there's a lack of reality in the nuclear question that I think Ian's put his finger on very nicely.
The nuclear question is also something that puts them in common with the Green Party, although the Green Party, it really is a theological, ideological sort of thing for them. They really don't want nuclear power for that reason. And you got some answers from them as well, Ron Martins.
Yes, they're an interesting party. They came out very badly when we did this project during the European elections last year. And actually, as a result of that, they invited me to their party conference to speak on evidence-based policy.
Hang on, are you the Green Party science candidate or something?
No, not at all. No, I was a purely independent, you know, outside observer. But they asked me to come in and repeat my criticism to their faces, effectively. So I went down to Brighton expecting to be lynched. But they're
vegetarians. They wouldn't be strong.
Well, exactly. They're a difficult party to pin down because there are various factions within them. There are areas that they just haven't really managed to make much progress on. In health, they've improved a lot since last year. They've dropped some of their support for alternative medicine. But their objections to genetically modified food, to nuclear power, to animal testing are purely theological.
Robin, what do you think of the Greens?
Well, I was glad you asked me that. I see nothing in anything that they've said that would make me want to vote for them, unless you live in Brighton and vote for them there.
Yeah, Caroline Lucas is the only Green candidate that has a chance of winning. And, I mean, she would be a good thing in Parliament overall, just for, again, Evan Harris' purposes, needling whoever's in Parliament, whoever's in power, to make them do some of the lefty things that, you know, perhaps
us, we want. I'm depressed at how ill-informed they are. I find it annoying. I like the idea of a Green Party where they're competent, and I don't think they are. And I think that's a real shame. They wouldn't have the knowledge and the expertise to be the equivalent of Evan Harris. And I think that's just a shame. I think they need to sort their act out, frankly.
Well, maybe you could vote for UKIP then, Ian, the United Kingdom Independence Party. Martin, I don't know where to start with this lot, but anything?
Well, it's hard to say anything sensible about their policies because there's nothing really there to analyse. I mean, it's just utter
nonsense. Who responded to you?
Viscount Christopher Monckton.
So Viscount Christopher Monckton, what was one interesting thing he said? First of all, he wants a Royal Commission on global warming. I mean, the United Kingdom Independence Party might want to take us out of Europe, but what have they got against you, global warming? Surely.
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting that actually, if you look across politics, there's quite a large correlation between Eurosceptic MPs and MEPs and climate denialism as well. If you look at our contingent of MEPs, it's very striking. So whether it comes from some sort of ideological, slightly libertarian, right-wing position that they see it as a way for the state to interfere in personal lives, I don't know. That could be an explanation for it. But it is a theological opposition, to use Nick Clegg's favourite word.
I think also, we should wind this up probably, but my favourite line in the analysis you've done so far was from Christopher Monckton talking about stem cell research, as long as it didn't kill little children. Did we kill little children to do stem cell research so far?
I think
did we do that?
They were. He said that stem cell research should go ahead as long as it doesn't involve the killing of very little children. I think I read that as perhaps meaning embryos, but I'm not sure. He may mean very little children, like people who lived on Floris, tens of thousands of years ago.
Put this man in charge of our country immediately, I say. Okay, we'll leave that stuff there. We'll come back to the election a little bit later with another slightly more evolutionarily based analysis. But you can read Martin's expert words on the party political responses at guardian.co.uk/science. You can also follow this podcast on Twitter at Science Weekly is what you need to search for. And if you want to know more about the rest of the Guardian and Observer's science content, follow Guardian Science. Martin, you're on Twitter. What's your handle?
MJ Robbins.
So follow him for more interesting things.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Let's have a look now at some of the other science stories around this week.
News Jack.
An asteroid coated with ice suggests the ingredients for life came from space. The space rock, called 24 Themis, is roughly the size of Sicily and orbits the Sun more than 300 million kilometres from Earth. The discovery supports the idea that asteroids may have brought plentiful supplies of water and organic material to our planet in the distant past, setting the stage for the emergence of life.
The Royal Institution seems to have drawn a line under its ongoing power struggle. Baroness Susan Greenfield and the 211-year-old scientific organisation have settled their sex discrimination case in an undisclosed out-of-court settlement. The two sides had been arguing ever since Greenfield was dismissed as director of the centuries-old institution, which is facing mounting debts following a multi-million pound refurbishment of its Mayfair home.
An extraordinary display of chimpanzee behaviour has been caught on film. It shows their emotional response to death. In the final hour, they huddled around the member of their group, studied her face, and shook her gently as if to revive her. And when the others had drifted away, one stayed behind to hold her hand. As our closest evolutionary cousins, the footage gives us insight into how humans deal with death and also challenges procedures for dealing with terminally ill animals in captivity.
And great news if you own a hot dog stall next to a comedy venue. Laughter may boost the appetite. The discovery could lead to laughter treatment for patients who have lost their interest in food. It builds on previous work in which the same scientists claimed prolonged laughter can lower blood pressure and boost immune activity. Volunteers had to watch either a stressful or a humorous 20-minute video. One was the brutal opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan. The others could choose to watch comedy videos and stand-up acts.
So let's talk about some of those stories. Asteroids bringing water and possibly life to the Earth, Ian.
This was a really nice study, actually. It's the first time people had seen a coating, if you like, of frozen water on an asteroid, rather than just the water being bound in as hydrates within the sort of minerals of the asteroid. And they found it by looking at just basically the infrared light bouncing off the asteroid as it was flying around between Mars and Jupiter in the main asteroid belt. It's a really interesting idea because asteroids, as say, may have come and thumped Earth, certainly did come and thump Earth in the past.
I think the period 4 billion years ago was called the late heavy bombardment.
Yeah, for good reason.
For good reason. Millions of asteroids smacking in, leaving their water. I mean, that's how the Earth got its oceans.
That's one argument.
That's one argument. Do you have another one, Robert?
Yes, volcanism. The standard theory was volcanism, and it was venting of water from the Earth's interior in the form of steam.
But how did the molecules get there in the first place?
How did the water... not from bombardment by asteroids, though, at the actual formation of the Earth.
Oh, I see.
I agree with you, it's probably asteroids. But there's a debate amongst astronomers about that.
Well, the atmosphere certainly must have come from volcanism or that sort of process. But
yes,
but so Ian, you were saying we interrupted you.
No. I mean, the interesting thing was I was talking to these astronomers about how why the Earth would have been dry when it formed, and they were saying, well, you know, the water would have been a vapor, and it wouldn't have got locked into all these sort of agglomerates of particles and such like. I mean, I don't know how accurate that is or if other theories allow for other ideas. I'm sure they do. And you'd imagine you would need a hell of a lot of asteroids coming and thumping into Earth to give you enough water for oceans. But what is nice about this is that, you know, Earth is the right kind of size, larger than Mars, so that when water is dumped off here, and you know, presumably an asteroid would strike, the immense amount of heat would produce, you know, most of this water would turn into a vapor. But the gravity of Earth would keep that vapor here rather than it just drifting off into space like it might do, you know, more so on Mars. And given enough pelting, you know, maybe you would build up enough to form an ocean. There were certainly a hell of a lot more asteroids around in that era. I mean, it's a very clean solar system at the moment because the planets have battered into so many of these things. And it was just nice that this research supported that idea as a possibility.
And we're gradually sort of moving away from this sterile view of the solar system as a bunch of rocks and gases and getting this more sort of, you know, kind of organic feel to it over you know, the last few years of research. It seems to be much more likely that there could be life elsewhere on the basis of, you know, the stuff that we're finding now.
Fingers crossed that there's life elsewhere, although Stephen Hawking thinks we shouldn't go anywhere near it in case it destroys us. Well, let's move on to chimpanzees. There's two studies published last week looking at the emotional impact that death seems to have on chimpanzees, Ian.
So this was two different studies published in the same journal. One was from the University of Stirling, where they had installed some video cameras in a nearby safari park, and they had filmed essentially the death of one of the an adult female from a group of four in that zoo. And the zookeepers and the vets were going in daily and spending time and essentially giving this chimp palliative care. But they were also observing what the group response was, and it was really quite poignant, although I'm aware you have to be very careful about what is anthropomorphizing and what is legitimate sort of assessment of their behavior. But you had in the last few sort of moments, this female chimp sort of wandered off to a nest and lay down, and the other chimps came along and they were sort of staring at her face. They were gently shaking her. They seemed to be lifting her limbs and letting them drop and looking for signs of life. And they were sort of brushing things off her and caressing her and things like this. And then they seemed to reach a group conclusion that she had died, and two of them left and one of them stayed behind and sort of held her hand for a while.
And in the second study, this was in the wild, looking at a community of chimpanzees in Guinea.
That's right, yeah. This was some researchers at Oxford who'd been studying a sort of semi-isolated group of chimps in Guinea. And five of them, these chimps, were wiped out by a respiratory disease. Two of them were young juveniles, and it's actually pretty tragic. But the mothers carried the corpses around for weeks, and in one case, more than a month or two. And in the heat and the conditions, I mean, these corpses mummified, and in time, the mothers would let they were grooming them, they were taking them with them to their day and night rest places, and they were keeping flies off them and all sorts of things. And then as time went by, they would do what the researchers believe was trying to sort of break the bond and ease, you know, let them go essentially by letting other adults look after this corpse. Or in one case, I mean, a smaller chimp was just blatantly playing with it, which was pretty macabre, actually.
You can see the video of this on our website with the story. And I had a look this morning. And look, I'm not an unemotional man, but it was more macabre than moving. This little chimp was sort of taking this mummified, sort of, let's say, cousin, and just wrapping it around a tree, throwing it around. If this sort of thing happened in human society, you'd think that kid would grow up as a serial killer or something.
Yeah, I found that really hard to watch, actually. But then after that incident, where the corpse is being dragged around this tree by this young one, the mother takes it and uses this classic maneuver for putting the dead baby on her back as if it was still alive and carrying it along, and she goes off with it. And there's, you know, the researchers are saying, look, this is all, they're drawing all sorts of conclusions about what this behavior means, but it's really hard to know what it really means. It's these are interesting observations, and I don't think anyone's claiming they're anything but that at this point, but it's some of it's moving, some of it's just intriguing.
For more on all of this stuff, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science, and remember, those videos of the chimps are there as well.
Science Weekly.
Political parties and spin doctors would love you to believe that it's a careful analysis of policy that people go for when deciding on their vote. Others argue it might just be down to whether or not you like someone. You could call it your animal instinct. So we asked The Guardian's resident evolutionary psychologist, Carol Jamie, to look past all the image management and PR. How do the three main party leaders, that's Nick Clegg, David Cameron and Gordon Brown, compare to apes when it comes to getting our approval?
If we bring this election down to evolutionary basics, we can see that really what it's all about is becoming Britain's alpha male. And there are certain benefits that come with being an alpha male. You get the best sleeping sight. So I don't know what the master bedroom at number 10 is like, but it's probably pretty good. You get to eat before anybody else, you get the best pickings, and you usually have increased breeding opportunities. You're solicited for sex, and you have a full tummy. You don't go hungry. So you're in a good position if you're an alpha. But it's a difficult role to attain and a difficult role to retain. And this is what Brown is facing at the moment, because you need to be in your prime to be an alpha.
There's a lot to this job. I don't get all of it right. But I do know how to run the economy.
We don't want a prime minister who's not in their prime. We want a strong, fit leader. We want someone with a good mind and a strong body who is definitely in their prime and can protect us and protect the number 10 sleeping site and be secure in their position. And to show off the fact that you are in your prime, it's not just getting a lot of voters behind you, it's not just amassing an army of support. You also need to show that you are desirable to the opposite sex. And that you are getting mating opportunities, because prime and being in your prime normally correlates with increased breeding. The fertility of our ape party leaders, Clegg, Brown and Cameron, are of great interest to us. And which one is the sexiest? Sex sells. We all know that. All primates are interested in sex. We like to watch each other having sex, and chimps like to pay a lot of attention to who's breeding with who, who's reproducing.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
So, for example, if we think of Kennedy, we know he had a lot of lovers. We know he had, you know, many famous females chasing after him. If we look at Cameron, Clegg and Brown, we don't see that many females chasing after them, as far as I'm aware. You know, they're all married and they've all managed to produce children. Cameron makes it clear to us that Samantha is expecting, and that's a sign of how vital and fertile he is, and therefore he is in his prime, and, you know, we should vote for him. Clegg has managed to produce three sons. This is very good in evolutionary terms, because sons can, if given the opportunity, reproduce more times than females, because their reproductive investment is much shorter. You know, a female is pregnant for 9 months. A male can just spend one night with a female and become a parent after that.
Immigration in this country has been too high for too long, and that's why we have a very clear approach to cut it. And cut it quite substantially. I mean, in these last.
When Clegg, Brown, and Cameron talk about immigration, they are all pressing our primordial buttons, because chimps are xenophobic. All ape species are highly territorial. They don't want stranger apes from their own species coming over and trying to steal their females, trying to encroach upon their territory. They don't want that. And if they meet stranger males, they will attack them, and if they can, they will murder them. And chimps patrol their boundaries in a similar way to the way Cameron says he wants our boundaries patrolled by a strong police force.
You can't say anything about the immigrants, because you're saying that you're
no.
But all these Eastern Europeans, what are coming in, Where are they flocking from?
Million people come
when Brown was in Rochdale, he had a chat with an older adult there, Mrs. Duffy, and she was expressing her primordial concern about strangers coming to this country. She's got concerns for her grandchildren, and she wants to be sure that her lineage, her gene pool, are going to be able to survive. And how will they survive if they've got to compete with strangers? Brown really needed to sort of empathise with this woman a little bit more, and he needed to turn his mic off. Unfortunately, he didn't.
That was a disaster. She'd never have put me with up with that woman.
What did she say?
Oh, everything. She's just a sort of bigoted woman that said she used to be a lady.
Well, it's possible we may see a hung parliament, and that's going to be quite interesting. I mean, Clegg's been talking about cooperation. You know, primates need cooperation to survive. Brown and Cameron are not showing that much cooperation towards him at the moment. They're trying to distance themselves from him. But were they chimps, they would be behaving differently. They'd be sort of getting right on with the business and not caring what anyone else thought. So you would see Brown and Cameron competing with one another to seduce Clegg to be their beta male, to be their second in command, if you like. And once they'd groomed him and given him confidence, once they'd got Clegg on their side, the two of them then would gang up against the other one, and they may well kill the other one. I don't think we will literally see that in Westminster, but metaphorically we probably will.
You can read more of Carol's analysis on her Evolutionary Agony Ant columns. Go to guardian.co.uk/science. Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks to Ian Sample and Robin McKee. Robin, a quick word before you go. Do you remember what's in the Observer Science page this week?
Some kind of stuff by a guy called Sample or something.
Ian Sample. What's in it?
Oh, yeah, that's a name. Yeah.
What have you done?
Well, I think Robin was too busy on his sort of lattes and croissants this week, so I ended up writing for the Observer, which was an honour. And I interviewed an amazing woman, actually, a photographer from New York who is travelling the world, taking pictures of the oldest living things. The images are stunning, I've got to say.
Okay, fantastic. Well, that's in the Observer Science pages this week, and also on the website if you haven't managed to get yourself a copy of the paper. Thanks also to Martin Robbins and to Carol Jamie too this week. Next week, Anil Anantswamy will be discussing the edge of physics, and no doubt we'll have something to say about whoever's won this election we've spent most of this podcast talking about. Don't forget to leave your thoughts for us at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And while you're at it, make sure you subscribe to our podcast. That means that every show will be automatically delivered to your iPod or other MP3 playing device. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.